sometimes felt that I ought to write down some more of the things that I have observed, but I don't like to write, and I don't feel that I'm really a good writer. I did write down my own life history, as most of you know, and I was told by one of my good friends that if you're bothered with insomnia, it's the best thing they've ever hit to put them to sleep. So I would say that I have two or three copies here if you're interested at all, but that's not what I came here for. My years prior to coming to McPherson, which was in 1902, I think might tell you a little bit why I feel towards McPherson as I do. I was born in Nebraska, just 2 miles across the line, just 2 miles to Kansas. My people had settled in that part of the state, a very poor part of the state, as a matter of fact, in the hills, and I lived in a very primitive home. I don't want to say much about that, but because of the influence it had on my later life, I think I was just mentioning the fact that if I were to tell you that I spent the first 9 years of my life in a sod house, that would not be very different than about half of my neighbors, and I'm satisfied that the house in which I lived the first 9 years of my life cost less than the poorest house that anyone lives in the first. But I don't want you to pity me or think I was an underprivileged boy. There's a little jingle that tells my story so completely, I think that I'd like to repeat it. It runs like this. You may speak of your wealth untold. Caskets of silver, coffers of gold. But richer than me, you will never be. For I had a father who read to me. My father had not gone to school many months even, but he was a good reader and he loved to read. And one of the choicest memories of my childhood would be erased if I could not remember the many, many hours that I remember my father reading to me. In addition to that, my mother had been a school teacher and was very much interested in education. We never heard anything other than the fact that education was the one thing we must have. It's interesting to me, too, along that line. In the primitive community in which I lived, the only church we had, it was called the Dunkard Church then, Church of the Brethren. We had no building. We met in a schoolhouse. And it was not a very elaborate schoolhouse, I assure you. But the one thing that I heard over and over again, because McPherson College had been founded the year before I was born, the dream of my parents was McPherson and McPherson College. I never had my father or mother tell me exactly why they did what they did so far as my schooling is concerned. I went to high school 1 year, and I do remember them saying, he's not going to go to a public high school anymore. Now, I don't know whether I wandered too far from their ideals or not, but they apparently thought that a church-related school would be a wonderful place. And to me, it was a new paradise that I dreamed of when I thought of coming to McPherson. And it was almost that to me, because I had lived 9 miles from town. We had no telephone. There was no rural delivery. We had no means of transportation other than a team of farm horses. And, of course, the town we went to was very small. When I came to McPherson and saw a little different type of school building, really a little different type of town, and a very much improved standard of living from anything I had known, it became almost a paradise to me. And I suppose that I evaluate McPherson a little higher than I should because of that kind of a background. Now, pardon me for that much personal history. What I came to do is to talk to you a little bit of some observations of changes that have taken place in the last 72 years. Now, I thought when I promised to do this that I would take time to verify a few dates and a few figures that I'm planning to give, but you know, that flu bug once in a while gets a hold of folks, and I haven't felt much like working for several weeks. And then, too, Mrs. Moore spent some time in the hospital. Didn't come home quite as spry as she is ordinarily. So the days when I should have been verifying some of the facts that I'd like to present this afternoon, I did not take time to look into them as I had hoped that I would. However, I believe that it would not be very hard to prove the facts that I am trying to present here. Now, I have listed seven different areas in which I have observed changes since I came to McPherson in 1902. First one I'm going to mention is transportation. I got here too late to see the streetcar. It had ceased to be in existence when I came. And most of the information that I would give concerning it came from Dana Bosley, a close neighbor of mine for many years from College Hill. He told me this fact, which was to me very interesting. He lived south of town, you know, where the old postal home was, probably. He said they'd drive a team of horses, probably to a wagon. They'd drive out to the corner. He said the cemetery corner. That would be, if I understood him right, correct, about where the Mennonite church is. They'd tie their team of horses to the wagon, feed them, and then they'd ride the streetcar from the town. It cost 5 cents. Mm-hmm. And they'd do their shopping and would come back on probably the next car or sometime a little bit later. That gives you a little idea of the territory that the streetcar covered. But I came here too late to see that. I came here as a student at the college, in the academy, as a matter of fact, and our transportation was either walking or riding a bicycle. There were no students that I remember that had horse and buggy or a horse. I mean of the boarding students. There were students who drove in from the country and would hitch their horse there to the hitching racks until they chose to go home in the evening. But the rest of us depended on walking or riding a bicycle, and I didn't have a bicycle. So that's the way I got around. That was transportation as I knew it as a student. And speaking of horse and buggy, this was truly the horse and buggy days. I remember very well a livery stable. Now, Lynn, I hope you correct me on this. The memory that I have of it, it must have stood just about where the community building does. And it was in existence there for quite a while. Don't know what year it ceased to be present, but there was a livery stable there where farmers could put up their team, feed them if they chose to do so. Liverman always kept them beside the horses, and he'd rent you a team of horses and a buggy, and you'd get around that way. Well, it quite a little change since then, but so it was. Anyway, the first automobile I ever saw was in McPherson. And it was owned by Mr. F.A. Vanlis. I have been told that that was not the first car here, but it's the first one that I saw. It's possible that Dr. Machette had a car earlier than that. This car was interesting, had one cylinder. I remember it as a hot mobile, but that might not be correct. 1903, Mr. Vanaman and Dr. H.J. Harnley decided to drive to Colorado Springs. And they drove that car to Colorado Springs. There were no garages. They stopped at a blacksmith shop when they needed any repairs. There were no filling stations. They bought their gasoline in the grocery stores. And they had 2 5-gallon cans that they took with them as their supply of gasoline. This much I do know, it was the first car that had traveled over that highway from Garden City to Colorado Springs. Now this is all a matter of record. Probably in the year about 20, not too sure of that, of course, the date, Mary Harnley, daughter of Dr. Harnley, wrote up that complete story and sold it to the Christian Science Monitor. I would not be surprised, and there's a copy of that in the city library. It is on record, and I have read the article in there, but I do not have a copy. But the truth of the story is correct, as I have given it. They were the first car to make the trip from Garden City to Colorado Springs. Dr. Harnley told himself that they averaged just at 100 miles a day, which I think was pretty good when you remember there were no even graded roads. There was no marked highway. And he said they, with their map, when they'd get to a town, they'd ask the way, how's the easiest way or the closest way to get to this next town. And they just found their way along, something like that. Now, you can't talk about transportation without thinking of your streets. I saw McPherson, Main Street, not paved, and hitching racks on both sides of the street. I can imagine a little what it looked like following a two-week lane or something of that kind. I am not positive of the date, but I think that Main Street was paved about 1903 or 4. Paved with brick. The brick continued to be exposed surface until a comparative few years ago when a new covering was put on the top of that. The next street that was paved was Euclid Street, I think in 12, paved from Main Street out to the college. I know when I came to college, that the next year, which was the year I came here as a teacher in the academy, a pavement had just been put in. They called it macadamized. Macadam pavement was a rock, coarse rock with a finer rock put on top, rolled down, and cemented together simply by the limestone in the rock. Well, it proved to be a complete failure. There was a lot of rain that fall and winter. Long before spring, there was just a series of chuck holes of muddy limestone rock. The bonding company that had guaranteed the work went broke and disappeared, and I understand the city was never able to collect anything for the $2 of payment. But that was the first payment that I had that really any experience with. Well, so much for that, transportation. The next thing I want to mention is the city itself. I remember they said they had took 2,500 people. But I also remember Professor S.B. Fenestock, who was a member of the town council, or I don't know what they called it at that time, and quite a booster, saying in a public address that he was tired of hearing 2,500 people. Says, this is a city of 4,000, and I want you to call it that. Now, I don't know. That would be a Chamber of Commerce report, but I do remember that. The stores, the things that we've seen change in this time is very interesting. I'm not too sure what every store was on, either by an individual or by a local group of people. Grocery stores, the grocery store that I remember best was the Maple Tree Grocery. It stood on the west side of the street, and there was a big maple tree out front of it on Main Street. Another store that I remember the first when I first came was the Alliance store. That was a really a cooperative store formed by the Alliance, the Alliance political party, really the group that formed it, and it was in existence for a number of years, perhaps 29 or something like that, when the Depression came, and of course then it went to visit. There were other grocery stores, but I'm not too sure of the name. I know there was one on Main Street owned by people with a Swedish name, whether Johnson or Swanson or whatever it was.
Lynn Bloom and Roseburg.
No, Lynn Bloom and Roseburg were not here in 1902.
Oh.
I'm sure they were not. But, of course, they were one of the old stores. When I came back here as a teacher, I was out a year. And then I came back in 1905. Strong's Grocery was the leading grocery store at that time. And I remember Mr. Strong telling me this, that they were raising money here on Main Street for something. And he said they expected him to pay just twice as much as the other grocery store did. And he said, if my store isn't that big. But he had a very prosperous store for a number of years. First started as Strollman Stutzman, but the Stutzman did not stay by the store. The banks, interesting to me, in 1902 there were four banks in McPherson. They were the People's Bank, the McPherson Bank, the Citizens Bank, and the Farmers and Merchants Bank. Now I think the Swedish German Bank was organized in 1903. I asked Stanley Sargent here for a few facts just yesterday, and he gave me some very interesting old records, but I never wanted to get records on the banks there. And Mr. Mingenbach was head of the Swedish German Bank, and I read an article just yesterday that he had written asking people to patronize their bank. And this was written in 1904. And he says, we have grown more in the last 12 months than any other bank in the city of McPherson. And their total assets were $74,000. Now, that meant all their deposits and everything added together. The People's Bank, which became the largest bank in McPherson in 1909, in 1902, the total assets of the People's Bank, which meant the deposits and everything, all the money that they could get their hands on, they had $15,000 capital stock, which they did not increase until 1909. But their total assets were $119,105.29. Now, there isn't a bank in McPherson that has individual depositors that have more money in the bank than the total assets of People's Bank at that time. They were not the largest bank then, but in 7 years later, they were the largest bank in McPherson. Just a word about garages. Well, there wasn't any garage. There were no garages. Sometime about 1905, I think, there was a couple of fellows, I don't recall their name. They had a machine shop here on South Main, it's on the east side of the street, and they built a car. Some of you people could help me out on this, I know. I saw the car, never rode in it. I imagine it would look a little bit odd if you could see it today. But they were supposed to be able to repair tires and do the help out of cars at that time. But there weren't too many cars as yet. Well, so much for that. There are a lot more things that you said about the city. But if I want, if I don't speed up, I'll have you here longer than I meant to. I'll be here longer. You may leave. The next, number three that I want. first doctor that I ever saw in first was Dr. Hall. Dr. Hall had a hospital. I was in the hospital. I mean, I visited in that hospital. And as I would remember it, it was on Maple Street, but just a little bit south of South Maple. It was just a house that had been made over into hospital rooms. I often wondered, as I got thinking about this, just what they really had in that hospital. I wonder what kind of nursing service they gave me. As a matter of fact, I've been tied up a little bit with the seizures, and the demands there are almost prohibitive. I don't even know enough, but the three of the nursing homes in the first are scheduled to close by January 1st this year because they cannot meet state requirements. I imagine that the Dr. Hall's hospital could not have met them. At least, I don't know what you thought. The second doctor that I remember was Dr. Machen. And so far as I can recall, in the early days, those were the only two doctors that I saw. And just what year Dr. Machen came, I do not know. He might have been here in 1902, but he was one of the early doctors. Dr. Dean was, those are the three doctors that I remember in my early years in McPherson. Dr. Neeson, Quantius, and Leibel came somewhere near the same time, probably about 1905, something like that. And Dr. Easton was my family doctor for many years and one of my very dear friends. So I feel safe in saying he was a good psychologist. I remember that his remedies was an enema and a dose of gastro, and you could live by tomorrow. That was pretty much it. A cheerful smile and assurance that you weren't very sick after all, which was probably generally true. But you can't blame them at all. In fact, I appreciate the work that those people were able to do. The next thing I want to talk about ties up right with this, and that is the immunization and drugs or medicines that they had at that time. Smallpox vaccination had been in existence for a few years in 1902, but a large percent of people were afraid of it or did they not believe in it. And when I tell you that I had smallpox after I came to McPherson, you might know that my parents belonged to the group that didn't have any faith in vaccination. And when it was discovered that my wife had smallpox, and I had, of course, been back with her all the time. Dr. Easton, who was our doctor, became very much excited about the thing. Most towns had pest houses, or a large percent of towns did, but the person didn't have one. They found an old house out on College Hill, and they moved us into it, and it was labeled as a pest house. And they'd bring our food to the back porch. We had been living in the dormitory, and they'd leave, and we'd go out and get food. I remember when Dr. Easton would come, he had an old slicker overcoat that he hung out on the clothesline, and when he'd come, he'd put on his slicker and come in and be careful not to touch us or anything else, and leave, taking off the slicker and going on. Well, I'm very happy to say that there were no added cases. Smallpox. His smallpox was very common, as were some of the other diseases, or some of the other kids. The other immunizations. I just picked up something on TV the other day. Some doctor saying that he was a pediatrician. He said that he vaccinated every child before they're 6 months old for seven different things. And you know what's happened. You've read The Horse and Buggy Doctor by Dr. Hertzler. Remember the sad story he had in there of visiting the home when diphtheria was present. thing that you haven't heard of for a long, long time. But I remember very well, after I came to McPherson, deaths in homes, deaths of children, especially I remember with diphtheria, and several other of the diseases of which we almost do not hear at all, were very common at that time. The immunization for these other diseases, against these other diseases, you are quite familiar with about when they began coming. But as to drugs, now I heard Dr. Harmon say one time that medicine doctors had only one specific against diseases. In other words, they only knew one drug that was definitely a specific against any one disease. And that drug was quinine. I didn't pay too much attention to it, but I heard it over the radio again, not over a month ago, saying that up until a certain date, the only drug, the only medicine they had that they really knew was a specific against the disease was quinine. And of course that was malaria fever is what it would control, and they still use it for that. However, malaria has become scarce in any parts of the country that we know about here. Now, I don't know how much more you should call it. I guess you should call it that. Only how thrilling it is when you think of the seriousness of those diseases and that they have been almost completely wiped off of the map. And that has happened since 72 years. Well, the fifth item I want to mention is agriculture. We used to have lots of farmers around here. I can best illustrate what I mean by telling something from my own observation. I've always been a great hand to count. I don't know, it makes me so mad at myself. I can't hardly go up a stairway without a count of stairs. But I had a case because of a type of work I was doing of making the trip west from here. And this came after I had a car. I didn't get a car in 1919. It's the first car I had. But there were 14 farmhouses between McPherson and Windham. There were 14 farmhouses. Do you want to know how many there are now? I haven't gone over that to count them for a while. But I think there's 3. I'm not too sure of that. Up until along in the 20s, Centennial Schoolhouse was quite a community center. And a lot of it even down where Centennial used to be. I think it's only about 5 miles out here. Something like that. Well, we passed 8 farmhouses and went out there. Now, I can go out there now and pass 3 farmhouses, or I can go another way and pass just 1. Successful tractors came probably in about 15, something like that, before they really became successful. 13 horses or mules. Now, that lets enough land go for the production of human food, a good many acres in every farm. And the style of farming has changed, not only so far as the methods used, but the crops that they produce. And no need to speak more about that. I'd like to mention just a little some of the other cities in McPherson County, things I've seen happen. I think I can best put it this way. I know that in 1912, there was a prosperous bank at Elyria. There was a bank at Conway. There was a bank at Roxbury. There was a bank at Winton. In 1912, all four of those villages had successful banks. And none of them have banks at the present time.
Roxbury still has a bank.
Does Roxbury still have a healthy clothing? All right, thank you for the correction. I thought they closed the store over there, didn't they?
Banks still have a healthy
clothing. All right. I thought it might be interesting to have just a little let your imagination run on this. I thought it would be interesting if I'd go back and try to count up how many stores I knew were in some of those locations. Largely, I guess, but the stores have virtually disappeared as well.
I thought there were three banks at that time. There's only one now.
All right.
There were two in Mount Ridge. There were two in Infamy, is that right? One now. So you've got partially right.
And I know there were four in McPherson in 1902. And I think the fifth one was organized in 1903. And it's an easy to see what has happened from the standpoint of story. I used to referee a lot of basketball, as probably some of your members will be. I remember the pay I used to get too. I worked a lot of games here from the first in high school, and they paid me $2 a game. I remember that very well. But I didn't have a car, didn't have any way to get around, but I have been successful enough, or either that or referees are awful scarce. And I got to work in games in other towns. I could make it real well to Windham, the Little River, and the Lions. And I don't know how many trips I made up there. Before I had a car, how'd it go? There was a passenger train on the Santa Fe that went through town about 5 o'clock, went west. And then one came back the next morning in time that I could teach my first class. And I remember, what am I going to do when I get out there? I spent many nights in the hotel at Windham. So Windham had a hotel. And I got my breakfast there for 25 cents. And I could get up in time for my breakfast, make the train, and get back to general in time to go home and leave my baggage there. But if the train was a little bit late, I just went to class without bothering to change my clothes when I was concerned. Well, when I was speaking of that,
What was the train fare?
What?
What was the train fare?
The train?
I don't remember. I think it was 2 cents a mile. Anybody correct me on that? I think I remember 2 cents a mile. And I expect that's going to be up there. I will remember 2 cents a mile.
Did they stop out for college?
I was just going to mention that next. All right. I want to speak a little bit about the railroads. At the time I came here in 1902 and on for quite a few years, there were four railroads that had passenger trains each way every day. And if you picked up a timetable of the Santa Fe train, you would see it listed as a city or a station between McPherson and Galva. You'd see College Hill. It was printed on the timetable. And many were the times, it was a flag stop, but many were the times that I stopped and took a train at College Hill. I know what we used to do. We used to get quite a little fun out of it. We'd go out there on time before time for the train to come, and just as quickly as it left town, so we could begin to see it We'd go out in the middle of the track and wave our suitcase back and forth, and the engineer would blow the whistle, and then everyone stops. If it's that way, either going east or going west. I remember once after I was here as a teacher, taking baseball team over to Galva, played the Galva team, and we all went out there, waved our suitcase, paid a few cent fare, whatever it was, after got on the train. Now, there isn't much more need to be said about the railroads. I don't know what the future is. We have no passenger trains at the present time and no indication we will have. I do remember that the Missouri Pacific had applied to the Interstate Commerce Commission for the privilege of discontinuing their railroad. And just about 29, I suspect, they struck oil here in McPherson. And they've been a pretty prosperous strip territory ever since then. And then, of course, now the Heston Company has come on to that track, and they carry quite a little freight, as a matter of fact. But they were ready to fold up quite a few years ago. Well, so much for that. The last thing I want to mention, we could guess most of this, things that McPherson College did not have when I came here in 1902. there was no city water out there. Where did we get a water? They had two wells. One was in the basement of Old Sharp Hall. You could go down there and pump water and get a drink. That continued for quite a few years after 1912. The other was that they had a well and a windmill out at the northeast corner of the campus. Where the Shaw building stands at the present time, and they had a supply tank. And that windmill was supposed to behave right and keep that supply tank filled. It worked good on some of the wind-chill days. We had to go downstairs and pump the water down there. But water did not come out there, so I'm not too sure. Probably should. Of course, that meant no modern facilities in your home at all. I'm only guessing at the next, but I'm guessing that there were 40 windmills on College Hill at that time. You had your own windmill and well, or you had trouble getting even drinking water. And that continued as well for about 82 feet. Supply of water at that depth. Not enough for the irrigation wells, as we have them now, but they were getting into the gravel at that time for the water straps. All right, we did not have water. And I told you how we got it. We had no electricity, which would have been impossible now. I don't know either when it came out there, but I know it was there in 1912. I don't know how much earlier. I think I could found it out. We had no city sewer. I think the sewer was put in about 1914. I remember so well when they were built. We had no mail delivery of any kind. Someone with a horse and buggy came uptown and got the mail. I don't know, I suppose every day, I'm not too sure of that, and it was distributed then on College Hill. We had no cars. I remember in 1913, the only faculty person that had a car was Dr. J.J. Yoder, and he had not made money to buy that car. He's in school, he's a farmer. In 1914, Dr. Kurtz and Culler came to the campus, and they each had cars. And in 1915, Dr. Harney got a big Texas wheat crop, and he bought a car. Now, those are the first cars that came, so far as the faculty was concerned. The first student Clay Holler. From Holler Harbor. He just had to drive out there and got it, but Frank Roberts, he kept his car there on the campus. All right. That's about the size of what we had or didn't have. No water, no electricity, no mail service. I am not sure if there's a telephone in the college. I know there wasn't in any of the colleges at the moment. And of course, no indoor facilities of any kind, at least we don't have been in the modern home today. Well, I think that's enough of your time. In conclusion, though, I just want to ask this. Who would like to go back to 1902? Things that you think I left out that you should have said. And Miss Mugler, I think this would be fine. That's all that you thought.
You might ask if they have questions.
Yes, or questions. All right.
I ran into something in the minutes of the city that I wanted to hear about. They mentioned that the city had changed the name of Cary Street to Cary Street from Cary Motors. I believe for many, many years. But the Moore family that were out there then, his name was Miller, Moore Miller, his mother was Moore. They run the sawmill out there. There used to be a lumber company and other called the sawmill, so they did something. Any other questions? If I can answer them, I bet you some of them can. Said later on, he turned around, went home. Here came Dr. Easton back, and his horse was just walking, coming forward. And so they stopped him and asked who was sick. Oh, he said, I don't think anyone was. I just stopped for a ride. And it was quite a common thought that doctors hurried to get to their patients. Here's a way to do it.
I remember one day when he attended the birth of four children, so he must have been very popular to be a Christian at that time. There were a lot of interesting stories told. The building of the Opera House is a story all its own. They got it built, but they didn't have any seats for the Opera House. So there was a committee formed to try to raise money, and they got seats. Then they had a big community gathering. Ben Ellison told this story. And he said that the mayor of the town, I've forgotten his name now, just a common name in the early times, got up before the group and he wanted to be orator. And he said, I tell you, fellow citizens, these men who got these seats ought to be exonerated. That was a big word anyway. This is rather a story that maybe shouldn't be told here, but I guess you're old enough to understand it. There was a man by the name of Bass. A. Bass. He always signed his name A. Bass. He was a great promoter. Good friend of mine. I learned to know him very well. But he had written a letter. This is the story. I'll have two stories about Bass. One was, he'd written a letter to some man back in the East and made a very glowing report about some land he had for sale here, some lots that had been worth a lot of money and so forth. The fellow, instead of answering the letter, he just wrote across the bottom. He says, "You may be a Bass, but I'm no sucker." Bass told that himself. But one time, this is a story that I... Sorry, my wife's here. I'll hear about this later. Bass had, without a doubt, done some shady things. I'm not judging that. But anyway, he had sold a tract of land to a man back east for $1,500. Not a cent, of course. The man came out to see the land, and it was supposed to be city limits. It was out in the pasture. So this man came back into the hotel, which was where the old Union Hotel used to stand. It was the first building there, however. He came in, the stranger came in, he says, "Can any of you people tell me where to find A. Bass?" "Yes, he's up there at the counter. That's him standing up at the counter." So this fellow goes up there, and he